Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live the good life and create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. So welcome to this edition of Edgy Ideas. Today, we have Nick Bolton, founder of and CEO of Animus Centre for Coaching and the International Centre for Coaching Supervision. Nick has a particular interest in the existential issues and complexities of 21st century life and is a leading figure in the art of transformative coaching. Nick, you're very welcome to Edgy Ideas. How are you today?
Thanks, Simon. Yeah, I'm good. As you know, I got the time wrong for this session. And I think that's a reflection in a way of exactly the sort of stuff I'm fascinated by, which is how do we navigate seemingly simple things and yet make them seem so complex? And of course, that's just a podcast interview. Then you add into that the whole issue of life and you're at another level, you know. So now I'm good overall. Thank you.
And where are you speaking from today, just so our audience can locate you?
From Canary Wharf in London.
Okay, good. So, I mean, it's interesting you've mentioned that kind of missed time this morning. I think that's interesting from our different approaches to coaching. It's like you're kind of humanistic, psychological, integrative, holistic, lots of existential work. I come at it from a psychodynamic perspective. So, of course, the psychodynamic question is always kind of when we forget something is like, is that a repressed issue? Are we kind of burying something? Do we want to do this thing or not? That's the sort of question which comes. What does your kind of humanistic approach ask when you kind of miss a meeting or?
Yeah, fascinating question. My first port of call is like, what's the environment that you built around you that leads to certain things? So rather than being psychodynamic, I'd almost say it's far more social and organizational, in a sense, somewhat more superficial. So I'm not a massive believer in the idea of everything being governed by unconscious drives. I do believe certain things are governed by that, but not that everything is a representation of that. So I'm more kind of interested in, well, okay, so what have you done with your life that means you're going to miss this meeting? How have you set those conditions up? Not deliberately, but just because you're trying to either do too much or achieve too much or whatever. Now, that could be the unconscious part. But the actual missed meeting is not a reflection of the meeting. It's a reflection of something deeper, further down the track. That's about how you've set your life up. That's the symptom that shows up at the end of it all.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you do kind of an exploration, is similar but different. I mean, I don't think everything is governed by the unconscious as well, but I think there's a dynamic between the conscious and the unconscious, and it's sort of and of course depending on which psychodynamic practice you use, people make different interpretations as well. So there's many different kind of ways of explaining it, if you're a Jungian or if you're a Freudian or if you're a Lacanian. So there's not kind of a unified approach, I don't think. But so you explore kind of the wider context, the kind of the person's kind of history, and see if there's patterns. Do you look for patterns in people?
Exactly right. You see, the way I look at it is me missing a meeting is not something I do a lot, but me being disorganized around time is. So I'm pretty good normally at getting times right for meetings because I force myself to by having a calendar. And I've actually missed a couple of meetings recently, ironically, and I've said to the people in question, if it's not in my calendar, my Google calendar, it's not in my head because that's my life now. So the missed meeting doesn't represent something psychological, but it does represent something systemic, let's say, about the nature of modern life. Now, then I might say to myself, well, what is driving me to be so busy? And that's where I think the unconscious part comes in. Like, what am I trying to achieve for myself that means I'm always stretching myself beyond what's realistic in any given moment? And that's like, that's the unconscious part that I need to look at, not the missed meeting.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I get that. And like, just to explore this further, for me, the unconscious part would be through busyness is also kind of what am I covering over? You know, you know, like if I stop being busy, kind of what am I afraid, which kind of might emerge, you know, some repressed feeling or some depression or something, you know, and kind of exploring that. You've got a very successful coaching company. I read on your website, is it 3,500 kind of in your network?
Yeah, about 3,500 coaches have come through our school since 2008, but it might be more now, something like that, though.
That's impressive. Can you just share kind of what kind of coaching it is? It says transformative life coaching, because I work on the organizational kind of leadership coaching side of things. What kind of coaches training are you doing there?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I was talking to somebody recently and I said things like life coaching and executive coaching, they're like containers in a sense. They're just the context that you're doing your coaching in and the type of person you're doing it in. But what you fill that container with is going to be unique to you as a coach. And in our case, we talk about transformative coaching, but we don't try to create transformative coaches per se. We want every coach to come out however they want to be and find themselves in it. So we don't have a process per se. It's rather a set of principles that we think govern transformative coaching. Now, when I talk about transformative coaching, I think most coaching at some level is transformative in as much as, but by what I mean by transformative is a critical reflection on your belief systems and what you take for granted and your assumptions and your values. And I think most coaching nowadays does that, not all, but most coaching does that to some degree. The question is to what depth. And so what we're trying to do is build an integrative framework for coaches to start to really meaningfully help somebody look at their belief systems and assumptions and yada yada, their worldview, let's call it, in a way that lets them move forward, whether that's in their life or their executive role or who knows what. I don't really care. I'm fascinated by how does somebody construct a worldview and a set of ways of seeing that constrain them or propel them in some way, and how do we as coaches help them actually look at that in a deliberate sense? So I often talk about intention versus attention, and I think our job is to help coaches become more attentional to worldview issues, paradigm issues, versus intentional to a particular kind of change. So I know that when you encountered the word transformative, I felt like you were looking at it from an intentional perspective, i.e. us transformative coaches have an intention to transform. And I don't think so. I think what we have is an attention to what's being spoken about that has a transformative quality.
Yeah. I mean, I as you know, you invited me very kindly to do a keynote for the Animus conference. So I kind of talked about this. I mean, my link to it is just how it's used in some of the management and leadership and world, where you get transformational leaders and they're kind of these agents of change who try and transform their followers and stuff. So it's really trying to play with that idea and kind of and try and understand what that does to the leader and what that does to the follower, because it creates dependency cultures and stuff. So trying to unwrap that. But the work we focus on in analytic network coaching, it's kind of, the focus is organizational leadership. It's kind of workplace kind of orientated, and which means bringing in kind of roles you take up. In when you train coaches, I'm curious, do the coaches come to you for training thinking that they're going to apply this in various settings, in workplace, in non-workplace, or is it mainly non-workplace? Is there kind of a sector you aim at, or a group you aim for?
I wouldn't say we aim at a certain sector, but we attract a certain sector, let's say. And so, for instance, we do have coaches that train with us and become executive coaches. But I would say the majority of our coaches want to become independent coaches who work as what you might call life coaches. I've never been a fan of that phrase, but a life coach is simply, you know, somebody who's working with an individual on any aspect of their life, and that individual is self-funding, so that it's not being governed by a sort of a tripartite system in the contract and all that kind of stuff. And so it's a lot more freedom than, say, executive coaching might have. But yeah, in terms of the skill set we teach, it could be used anywhere. I just notice we attract a certain kind of person, which is what you might call the life coach.
Yeah, and that's an interesting field for me, because I don't work in that field, and you know, my background is therapy, psychotherapy, you know, counselling, and the world I've grown up in and seen around me is, you know, I've seen counsellors everywhere, kind of really explode since I was younger, you know, which is, you know, in schools and education settings, in you know, in workplaces. employment assistance schemes, you know. And now I'm wondering where life coaching, to use that term, which I don't like either, but it's kind of it says something, which I wonder how it fits into that kind of that world of counselling, psychotherapy. Where does life coaching fit in from your perspective?
Yeah, it's a good question. I was talking about this at the weekend with a bunch of people who are considering becoming coaches, and that was a real question for them. Like, how is it different from psychotherapy? And, you know, and some of them came with the kind of the classic distinction, which is simply not true, which is psychotherapy looks back and coaching looks forward. And it's like, well, that's not true. You know, it depends on which school of psychotherapy and all this kind of stuff. So I started to kind of really thrash it out with them. And also there's a, you know, I don't know if you know Nash Popovich, who wrote a book called Personal Consultancy.
And he created the
Masters in Integrative Coaching and Counseling at the University of East London. I had a lunch with Nash recently, and we were talking about it too. So this is quite a present thought for me. And what I've come to is that coaching is a particularly unique configuration of different aspects that you might find in other forms of therapy or counseling. And it's aimed at a slightly different audience. And so whilst counseling will attract a certain kind of person, and whilst psychotherapy might attract, when I say a certain person, I don't mean that, I mean a person at a particular stage or struggling with a particular issue, let's say, coaching might take a lot of those different things, put them together in a very particularly unique, energetic way. But when I say energetic, I mean the energy of what it focuses on is somewhat different than, say, counseling or particular psychotherapies. And it aims at a particular market, which is, let's say, non-clinical, generally speaking, emotionally functional. I mean, all psychotherapy and counseling that works with people who are emotionally functional generally, because otherwise they wouldn't be in, you know, wouldn't have got to the counseling session. But you know what I mean? There's like a different level. And so I think it's really less about what's different and more about what's similar, but who's it serving in a different way. And so I look at coaching, particularly the coaching we do, as helping individuals navigate the complexity of modern life. And I don't believe, by the way, that we live in this phenomenally complex world that no human being in history has ever discovered before. Like, I would much rather live now than in 1348 when the Black Death hit, you know what I mean? So I do think we feel more agency when confronting that choice than we used to have in the past. So I don't think that the complexity is greater particularly, but I do think our engagement with making choices is greater. And that's why having a thinking partner, let's call it a coach, is useful for navigating what's really going on for me and what are the choices I've ahead here and what am I going to do differently?
Yeah, now that's very interesting. You know, I mean, I did a lot of research and coaching for that book I wrote, Coaching Equitable Text, and it was interesting because there's a big critique of therapeutic culture and people saying that like therapy has gone beyond the boundaries of the wounded self, and now it's kind of moved into the territory of helping the well, and kind of what's all that about. And I think you just answered it really, and Nicholas Rose, kind of a famous scholar, also kind of answers it in a similar way, saying that, you know, people in this world, like you say, there is complexities. I think we're probably more emotionally engaged. You know, if you're a manager, even kind of 40, 50 years ago, if you're a manager, you kind of managed in a much more functional way. You weren't expected to do the emotional management so much. You know, you were task orientated and you kind of supervised people technically, but you weren't really supposed to kind of worry so much about people's feelings or, and so these days the world is kind of more complex in that sense. And they were talking about kind of counseling, psychotherapy. It's important for this world. And it's, really, I think that kind of life coaching has kind of stepped into that very place, really, saying that, yeah, to navigate our lives today means engaging with our psychological states, our emotions in a greater way, I think, and perhaps we're more isolated or cut off from community or something. Maybe old ways of holding us, you know, the church, community, maybe other places we used to do some of this work are kind of demised a bit. So we need new forms, and maybe life coaching has stepped into that place.
Yes, I think that's right. I think there's a lot of truth in that. And at the same time, it's different. It's not simply replaced, it's built on. The phrase I used was the classic Newtonian one of standing on the shoulders of giants, because it's not like coaching is like, oh, wow, where did that thing come from? I mean, it's evident where it came from. It built on the shoulders of what's gone before, and it's just another iteration of it. So that's why I say it's a unique configuration rather than being something completely different in itself. I'm also sort of struck by, you know, it becomes clear when you think about the extremes. I often think extremes is a good place to start at to think about some things. If I've got two human beings in front of me, and one human being wants to double their business in the next 6 months, they're not going to see a counselor or a psychotherapist. It's just so obvious to us that that's not the place. But that doesn't mean there isn't use for a thinking partner. But then if I've got somebody who's on the verge of committing suicide, they shouldn't be going to see a coach. So at some level, the extremes really tell us the difference. But of course, what happens is as we move into the center, it gets ever more gray. And that right in the center, you could kind of flip either side, therapist or coach, who knows? You know, if you're dealing with existential conundrums about living, you could easily see a psychotherapist, but you could easily see a particular style of coach. And neither's right or wrong. It's that kind of middle area where it's all getting confluent.
Yeah, no, that's very interesting. I mean, in my work, I talk about the wounded self and the celebrated self. And I say that, you know, most psychotherapists really focus on the wounded self. They focus on the pathology of the person, on thinking about reparation, on kind of making good hurt from the past, on how their dysfunctional lives might become more functional. It's very much around that. Whereas coaching often focuses much more on the celebrated self. And I believe the work is to work between those two places. And if it gets too polarized on the wounded self, then you need to go refer on to a counselor or a psychotherapist. But we all have kind of troubles in our lives, and we all have joys in our lives and strengths. So I think coaching is a unique configuration and does kind of work across that boundary. And I notice, you know, I attract quite a lot of psychotherapists onto my courses, and they often find it hard to kind of let go of the wounded self. It's kind of they immediately go to that place because that's how they're trained to kind of think and be. I have some other coaches who come from positive psychology, and particularly from the US, they come on my courses and they really struggle because they're in a new domain. So bridging those two, I think, is that new configuration and being able to kind of work with someone's troubles, but know when you cross a boundary where there's an extreme, then refer them to a psychotherapist if they're depressed, or a psychiatrist if they're depressed or whatever.
Yeah, 100%. I totally agree with that. And it's funny because I was thinking about myself recently. I was talking to my wife and I was like saying, I would quite like to see an existential therapist. And I thought to myself, why? Like, what happened in my mind that meant existential therapist felt more appropriate to what I was thinking about than existential coach, let's say? And it comes back to this energy thing. I don't use the word energy in a mystical sense, but simply, where are we focusing with the level of energy? And if I were to see an existential psychotherapist, I would expect the inquiry would leave more room for ambiguity and for sense-making in the long run by myself, whereas I feel like coaching fundamentally tries to crystallize the learning in the moment to some degree. There's something about that which is, it's not fundamentally different, and yet its energy is somewhat different. Does that make sense?
It does, and I mean, just a shout out for the Philadelphia Association. I saw two existential psychotherapists, and they were from the Philadelphia Association, which emerged from the work of someone's name I forgot. I'll come back to. But they mixed a bit of psychodynamic and existential, and it was exactly that. It was that place. You know, I wasn't terribly depressed or in terribly need of psychotherapy, but I did need a place where I could really think deeply about what had happened in my life and make some sense and make some connections. And it was really helpful, yeah.
Exactly, and that's different from coaching. And it's really hard to say why it's different from coaching. Like, the funny thing is that nobody can really just absolutely say what's different between coaching, counselling, psychotherapy. And of course, as you know, Simon, counselling and psychotherapy in the UK is not recognised as being fundamentally different, whereas in the States it is. So even those two aren't, you know, clear yet. So in a sense, we're always dealing in these grey areas of difference, and yet somehow we feel there's a difference. Now, my job as the owner of a coaching school is to train people who can work in that particular way that's right for coaching rather than psychotherapy or counselling. But when that line is broached or breached, whatever the word would be, you don't always know, you know, it's like a little fine line.
Yeah. Philadelphia Association, the name I forgot was R.D. Lang. So he founded it early on, but it's a really good experience there. I've become very interested in what coaching produces in a client, because I don't believe that a client just comes to a coaching session or a counseling session or whatever and just speaks from an independent place. I believe that it's shaped by that relationship between the two and by the setting and by the institution. So if you come to a life coach, your kind of expectations are going to be different from going to a counselor, and the way the counselor or the psychotherapist responds to you produces a different outcome in the speech and a different outcome in the engagement. And I'm very kind of interested in that, because quite often we ignore that and we just think, oh, well, a client comes with their problems or with their attitudes. And I don't actually believe that. I think kind of the wider culture around you and the clinical setting or the coaching setting, it makes a difference. Like if you go into a psychoanalyst and there's a couch there and you've got a 50-minute hour and there's a whole kind of rigor of psychoanalysis behind you, it creates a different kind of experience.
Yeah. Yeah. And even within the same practice, you know, I was talking to these potential new coaches at the weekend, and I said, look, every one of you could coach me on the same issue and we'd have a completely different conversation because of what you pay attention to. You know, one of you might pay attention to what you saw somatically in me. One of you might pay attention to what I said. One of you might pay attention to what, you know, what was not said. And each of those will produce a different journey. But you're also right that at a more meta level, psychotherapy, counseling, coaching has their own intrinsic kind of framework that we then respond to.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's kind of, there's a lot of like implicit and hidden rules, I think, you know, particularly in some approaches which don't look at depth of what they're doing. You know, some approaches, they, when they're more technique driven, then they don't often ask the questions about kind of how they're shaping that language. I trained first, my first training was in person-centered Rogerian counseling. I did a master's degree in counseling and psychotherapy at Keele University. And I was always bumping into the trouble. I'm saying, like, this is not, you know, unconditional positive regard, maybe, but we're not unconditioned, you know, we are conditioned. It's like, you know, we bring, you know, we want to kind of be non-directive for sure, but actually, you know, I'd watch these coaches and they'd be very directive in a kind of a non-directive way, you know, because, you know, they'd follow a path which kind of suited their psychology, very different to one I would follow. And it wasn't like one was right or wrong, but you couldn't help but see that we are directive, and even when we're trying to be non-directive.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I've noticed a tendency in coaching. So what happened for me, Simon, was that, well, not me personally, but when I look at the profession of coaching, is it started off very, very simple. It was the GROW model, and it was goal setting, and it was task orientation, yada, yada. And then there was the rise of coaching psychology, and it became ever more complex. And what I'm noticing is a return to simplicity at the moment. There's a desire in the coaching world to go, like, enough of that nonsense. Let's get back to coaching in its purest form. But what I've noticed, the people who subscribe to that are often very directive in their non-direction, to almost to the point of like, well, is that in the client's best interest, or are you just being a coach because that's your job title now? You know, and I find it very uncomfortable, because to me, coaching should be, at least to my mindset, the most egalitarian of all approaches, in as much as you've got two human beings who are coming together for the benefit of one, but with an inequality of mind, let's say. So when you downplay what your own sense making, you're really extracting something from the session, which is really actually useful. And so I'm not enjoying this kind of movement back to, I'm just a coach that has no thoughts and nothing. You know, I'm just going to ask you a one word, and it's like, is that really what the client needs? Is that really the best I can offer?
No, I mean, I think it's really problematic, and I think it's. Yeah, I don't think there's any such thing as non-directive. You know, I think, or neutrality. You know, we're not neutral. You know, even our body ages and our kind of how we show up in a room or how we show up on a screen kind of influences it. You know, there's gender differences. You know, there's all these things which have to be kind of taken into account. But yeah, there's kind of a puritanical kind of in a non-directional kind of thing, and in coaching where they say, you know, yeah, get rid of all the baggage and just be pure. But actually, you've still got the baggage there. You're just not kind of acknowledging it.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. My feeling is that I'm not a psychotherapist or a counselor, so I can only speak for coaching. But my feeling is that coaching should be about addressing what's happening between you in as honest and courageous a way as possible, rather than pretending there isn't something happening between you as two individuals. So in other words, I am thinking things, I am feeling things, I am noticing things that are unique to Nick Bolton in that moment. And for me to pretend that that's not happening is to be uncourageous, I would say, in the encounter of two human beings. And that's why I'm not madly a fan of what you might call pure coaching, where you just have these questions that you kind of trot out, if you like.
Yeah. Now, I think the dynamics of power are very interesting as well, because, you know, if you take one extreme of psychotherapy, if you go to psychoanalysis, you know, there's a clear power dynamic, you know, and to be fair to psychoanalysts, that they use that for the transference. You know, there's a method within that. It's not kind of a non-awareness of use of power. They set themselves up in that way to kind of allow transference to take place, so you can project onto them as father or mother figures, and then work it through and work through that transference. So there's a kind of an understanding. In coaching, there is a much more... And in psychotherapy, of course, there's the person with the problem, and there's the expert with the skills to sort of help that problem. So there's a power dynamic, you know. In coaching, it's different, and yet there is money paid. You know, there is, you pay for a session, and hopefully, you, as a client, you'll be expecting something from that expert. You know, so it's an interesting one. I work with quite a lot to try and understand kind of what is that power dynamic. And in my world, for example, it's very interesting, because there's a power dynamic of the client paying the coach for their expertise, but there's also the power dynamic of, you know, if I'm working with a CEO who's probably earning 20 times what I'm earning, and they have very powerful jobs and very powerful positions, and I need the labor, I need the work, I want to kind of keep the contract, there's a reverse power situation where, you know, they're buying my services, and do I collude with what they want, or do I courageously question them? So that the issue of power in coaching is on my mind a lot.
It's an interesting one, isn't it? And let's be honest, this is an existential issue, isn't it? Like, you're not going to get rid of that, but what you can do is address it head on as much as you can do. I think it was Nick Smith in the first Supervision in the Helping Professions. And anyway, it's a book written with Peter Hawkins, and he wrote a chapter called The Deference Threshold, where he talks about the idea that we might encounter somebody, let's say like the CEO you mentioned, where you suddenly feel your power ebb away because suddenly they remind you of an authority figure in your life, or you just feel inadequate versus their salary or whatever it might be. And you suddenly you move into this kind of deference mode. And I think, well, of course that happens, but how do we stop and go, hold on, let me name that, let me discuss this, let me bring it into the room, rather than kind of self-managing it or hoping it just doesn't matter. Let's get it into the room, because there's a good chance that is something that person's experiencing elsewhere as well.
Well, exactly, yeah. I mean, that's what I do with it. I mean, I often feel that because of basically my class background, you kind of have self-doubt, and you go into place. But, you know, I when I feel it strongly in a relationship, I always use it, because I say, you know, I'm sure that kind of people in your team must feel like this. Are you sure you're getting people giving you direct feedback about how you're coming across, or are they questioning some of your ideas? Because it's dangerous if they're not. And you know, if I'm experiencing this, I'm sure I'm not alone. So we, you know, we definitely use that kind of relationship as a, I mean, we in our work, we think about that relationship as that parallel process. You know, what happens in the room actually signify something which is happening outside the room.
Yeah, exactly. And it's funny you talk about your background, because I know I speak kind of poshish nowadays, but, you know, I grew up in Cornwall and had a very, very strong Cornish accent, and I deliberately lost it to come to London to study. But my dad was a scaffolder. My mum was a housewife. I was a working class kid, and I had no money, you know, so money was an issue for me all my life until I finally started my own business. But it's amazing how that does continue to impact me. I was talking to my managing director recently, and we were talking about stuff, and she was like saying, we're talking about like confidence, and I said, you know, I'm a confident person in some ways, but there's a definite part of me that's not confident, and I think that comes from my childhood. It's always there in the background somewhere. So then the question for me, of course, Simon, is, well, is this just my stuff? Like, is this really about the CEO, or is this my stuff? And then that's another question, isn't it? If it's really just an individual experience versus a transactional one, then that's just about you to manage. So it's like, and there's no way to know for sure. You've just got to constantly navigate these questions.
Yeah, you know, in psychotherapy training, they work on that in particular. So they work on kind of, you know, what's yours and what's not yours. And I guess that's another question for coaching. I mean, in psychotherapy, there's a very strong tradition of supervision, and you have to, you know, it's a much longer training process. You have to kind of do, you know, 5 years work on yourself before you can become a therapist, and then you continue supervision. What's your kind of experience in the coaching world around that? Because that question of kind of what's yours and what's not yours is, you know.
Well, when I started coaching, I don't think supervision existed at all. Now it does. I mean, I have a supervision school, and I've trained over 200 supervisors now across the world, from as far as China and Japan all the way to America. So that's really great. It's growing. That said, I still don't think enough coaches know what supervision is, why it matters. I mean, the word itself is a terrible word, of course. That doesn't help. But I think it's growing. I mean, more and more I'm finding that coaches either have supervision or want supervision, and they have some notion of it. And, you know, so hopefully over time that's really going to mature, because I think that's going to help coaches coaches and the coaching profession mature too. I often think of it like this, Simon, that training to be a coach is simply the gateway to a lifelong profession. Credentials don't do much for you in terms of development. They just kind of show you where you've got to. Only supervision is the thing that continues to help you grow beyond simply new skills addition like CPD. So I think, you know, supervision is essential for coaching in terms of that lifelong growth part.
Yeah. No, I agree. And the things I kind of say to my coaches is like, you know, there's three parts of it. There's like, always get supervised. You need supervised because apart from safe practice, it kind of is very good for your personal development. You know, you're always doing that kind of that work on yourself, and you're learning from others. I like group supervision for that, really. I run group supervision because I just love learning from kind of other peers as well. It's not just like one supervisor who has the knowledge. It's kind of more egalitarian and shared. And the other thing is ongoing learning. So we set up like the Ecolleagues Institute, a community of practice, which is ongoing, and it's very much kind of peer directed. And you know, we bring in thought leaders to speak, but it's very much peer directed. And that's another part of it, is that continual kind of questioning what's going on, learning from others is really kind of I talk about the formation of coaches. Like you say, you don't form just after a short training, or your formation is a lifelong kind of process.
When I trained as a coach first time, I was very much, I mentioned I learned the GROW model, and so I was very much a classic GROW model coach. You know, what's your goal? Where are you? What are your options? What are you going to do? Come on, let's get it done. And then over the time, I began to realize, wow, that's just not what I'm seeing in actual human beings. That, you know, they would pitch up with all sorts of stuff. I remember one guy showed up with a photocopy of his hand, which he'd sent off to America to have analyzed for the lines. And he showed it to me, and he was like, what do you think? Is that correct? And I was like, that was a brand new coach. I was like, that ain't coaching. And so, you know, you suddenly realize that what you learn it doesn't map to the reality sometimes. And so, you know, you mature over time. Blimey, Charlie, I've been a coach now for 20 years, and I feel like I'm still learning and growing as a coach in a way that I would never have dreamed of 20 years ago, when it felt so simple.
No, well, I know you're an avid lifelong learner. You're doing a master's degree and focusing on a possible PhD, is that right?
Yeah, that's the idea. I'm doing a psychosocial studies master's. I've always been fascinated by the intersection between what we do in our minds, what I would call the worldview, and the reality of the world as it is, which is why, you know, we have these two of our five principles are humanistic and psychological and systemic and holistic, because the two both happen to the same person. So I'm kind of fascinated by that. But I'm also fascinated by how psychosocial studies is being positioned. It feels like it's got a particular ethical framework, which to me almost undermines the point of psychosocial, because psychosocial should be open to what's possible rather than dictated to by an ethical framework that almost pre-configures the outcome of your research. So I'm kind of fascinated by how I'm going to experience this.
Yeah, I'm fascinated too. We've had a discussion before about how it's going to go for you. So I'm looking forward to seeing you on that journey. Do you have a focus for what you might study in the doctorate, or is that kind of open at the moment?
there's probably two strands, potential, very, very different strands. One is group coaching, which, like you mentioned, group supervision. I also love group supervision, and I love group coaching. And there isn't much research on group coaching. So that could be an interesting area. More likely, though, is I'm going to pursue the threads that I've often pursued, which is I'm fascinated by human beings as a temporal being. Well, all beings are temporal, of course, but as a temporal being that's aware of its temporality. And so I did some talks years ago. One was called the temporal self, and one was called time and timelessness in coaching. And I'm fascinated by when a client comes to you, how they're positioned in time, but they're not really aware of that until you start to draw it out. And so that may be a thread that I look at further, which is the relationship to time and life and coaching.
Very interesting. I started one of my coach training sessions the other day, and I asked each person to check in, and someone checked in and said that they got all the time zones wrong, and they were kind of befuddled. They were almost late for the session. They came kind of with that sort of energy of being kind of confused. And I said to them, you know, what's time meaning for you at the moment? Like, you know, what beyond kind of just this session does it mean, or some time zone does it mean for you, you know? And it took the person right into, I've moved into a different stage of my life. I'm thinking about how long I've got left. What do I want to do with this time in my life? How it impacts on us. And I think it's really, I think that'd be really interesting to do for coaching, because again, like psychoanalysis and psychotherapy, like traditionally are longer term. Now that there's this kind of idea that you need to be in the game for quite a long time. I mean, not there's short-term therapy and there's short-term counseling, there's CBT and stuff these days, but longer term psychodynamic therapy or psychoanalysis kind of really has a different longitude, and that changes things. And I often wonder with coaching, and you know, we can do it for six sessions, we can do it for 10 sessions, we can even do one-off sessions, you know, but linking kind of the time we spend with clients with kind of what time means to them and what time means to us, I think would be very, very interesting.
It is interesting. And there's been a shift recently to single sessions, hasn't there? Wendy Dryden is now really, really keen on single sessions. But also I listened to a podcast interview recently with Irvin Yalom, the existential psychotherapist, who I think is like 95 years old.
I was going to say, he must be very old. He's one of my favorite kind of...
Me too. Yeah. And one of the things he said in this podcast was, he said, look, my memory is too bad now to do multiple sessions because I don't remember what the person said anymore. So now he focuses purely on doing single session existential coaching, which is just beautiful, isn't it, if you think about it? Because yeah, really nice, and it makes you think, like, what is possible in a single conversation? You know, I when I did this talk on the temporal self, I started off by playing three different clocks, like tick 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 tick, and one was a really slow tick and so on, and I asked people in the audience to which one resonated most with them and reflected the way they felt about their life. And then I went on to talk about Philip Zimbardo's concept of the seven relationships to time, like past negative, past positive, future positive, and so on. And really starting to get people to just think in that moment, what's my relationship to time? And then what they do with it afterwards is almost down to them. So I think you don't need to necessarily kind of walk that path with them. It's just like, how can you raise awareness of these deeper issues of how we experience life?
Yeah, and like, you know, the other thing that's interested me a lot is I spend some time in some monasteries, and they pray for their brothers from 1327, and they pray that it's like they have a completely different idea of time, and they pray for them as if they kind of only died yesterday. It's an interesting, brilliant thing. And then I was talking earlier today from someone from the Aboriginal kind of First Nations peoples in Australia, and again, they're notion of time and understanding of ancestors and time is very different again. So it's it's really, really, really quite interesting. Nick, we're coming to an end. It's been really fascinating. I ask guests two questions at the end of the session around what it means to live a good life and what it means to create the good society. And I just wondered, reflecting on all your coaching experience, if you have any thoughts on those two issues.
I think the first one is truth. That probably matters to me more than anything else. What is your own truth? Not the truth, but what is your own truth? What are you facing or not facing? And I feel like I often describe this as being clean inside. I never lie about anything. Like, I'm super, super honest about anything, because I feel like the minute you do, it's like you have this toxicity inside you. So I figure for myself, the best thing is face the truth of your life and then make decisions on that basis. And it just keeps me clean mentally, I feel. So that's the first thing. And I guess the corollary of that is, what is a good society? One that allows people to live truthfully. That would be what I feel. Yeah.
That's nice. That's nice. Good wisdom to share. Nick, it's been really, really interesting. I'm looking forward to sharing this with lots of people. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Simon.